Thelema, Coast to Coast, show number 38, January 21st, 2007. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before getting into the show, I want to remind everybody to contact the podcast through email at podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com, through the website at www.thelemacoasttocoast.com, through voicemail at 206-600-5782, and voicemail is my preferred method of contacting the podcast. Through the postal address at Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, 30065. On the MySpace page at www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast, where there's already about 1,500 people friended to the account, and more are welcome. And then on the Frapper map that you can get through on the Thelema Coast to Coast website, where there's already hundreds and hundreds of people. And I love going and taking a look at where all the listeners are from. Okay, so now that we've got all of the contact information, and again, I want to stress voicemail is my preferred way of getting feedback, but I still like getting emails through the site or directly. The majority of the emails that I've received over the last 3 or 4 weeks is the persistent question of when's the next podcast coming out? Obviously, the answer is it's out now. But I want to address kind of the schedule. I'm always hopeful that it'll come out every 2 weeks or so. Recently, we all know that that hasn't been the case. And quite frankly, I don't know if I can keep that up in over the next year or so. With school and work and other requirements on my time, I basically can't promise to do that. I will put them out when I can. When I have material, when I'm getting in touch with people. The good news is I've got the next two podcasts lined up, assuming the interviews go through and everything. So some will be coming out in two more, I guess, over the next 5 to 6 weeks. And but from there, it just all depends on who I get on the podcast and the material and things like that. So they'll come out when they come out, and, you know, just keep your eyes out for them on the lists. Subscribe to the feed on my blog, and where I put notices about that, or on LiveJournal, or the feed on my blog on MySpace, or the feed on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. You know, staying on all of those will let you know when the podcasts come out. Or just keep an eye out in iTunes and have your podcatcher occasionally check the RSS feed there. So they'll come out as soon as they can, and I hope that's good enough for you all, because that's the best I can do. All right, so now we're going to get into listener feedback. As I've said before, voicemail is my preferred way, and so I have three voicemails, and I'm very happy to have received them. The first is from a listener named Cole, and here's what he has to say.
Hello, John. This is Cole from Amherst, and I'm just calling to tell you that I really enjoy Thelema Coast to Coast. It's brought up a lot of interesting food for thought, especially your and Keith's conversations on secular humanism and how it relates to Thelema. I especially enjoyed your talk on Liber E, and it got me to go back and look at the text, which I haven't done in a while, and begin working with it again. And I was wondering when you and Keith were perhaps continuing on your series, as you said you were going to do with those texts. Once again, thanks a lot for your fantastic show, and love the law, love under will. Bye.
Thanks for the comments, Cole. I really appreciate you taking the time and leaving them. Also, thank you for the reminder about Libra A and Libra O and that we haven't done those yet. I'll get back with Keith418 and see if we can address those in upcoming podcasts. The next voicemail is from a listener named Amber, and she has some very good questions. So here's the voicemail from her.
Hi, John. This is Amber Abreu calling, 93. I've been listening to your podcast, and I especially enjoyed the latest one, number 37, specifically the interview with Roger Williamson. I really appreciated all of his thoughts and his experiences that he had to share. And I definitely did check out his artwork and his books as well. The reason I'm calling is I kind of stumbled upon what might be an interesting topic. I don't know, you can decide for yourself. But I am a sort of a studier of philosophy, and I was doing some more reading on Carl Jung, and I was wondering how does Jungian psychology, specifically the collective unconscious, relate to the practice of magic and Thelema? And is it something that Thelemites would benefit from studying more in depth with regard to you know, facilitating their magical sort of evolution? It's just it's a topic that's been interesting to me since I was in high school. And it seems that some of his philosophies or his ideas sort of run along the lines of spirituality and artistic endeavors and creativity. And I know that these things can only benefit Thelemite, but I was just wondering what your thoughts are on Carl Jung and any other related theories or philosophies. Appreciate your show, and keep up the good work. 93.
Thanks, Amber. I appreciate you taking the time. And unfortunately, your questions regarding Carl Jung are something that I'm completely unqualified to answer. I've read a very little of his, and I don't feel qualified at all to be able to answer that. However, the previous guest, David Shoemaker, is actually a practicing transpersonal psychologist, is very familiar with Jung's work, and therefore I've asked him to answer the question for you. So here's David Shoemaker responding to your question, Amber.
Hi, Amber. This is Dave Shoemaker. I thought you had some really good questions about how to use the Jungian concepts in magic and mysticism, and you know what exactly is the overlap, or potential overlap there. And I thought of three or four things to say in response. First of all, you mentioned the archetypes and the collective unconscious, and I think fundamentally this is something that is such an important area of overlap between the work of Crowley and the work of Jung, because while they were coming at it from different places, you know, Jung was really getting at some very similar ideas in terms of the ways that mythical concepts and inner drives that seem to take certain shapes and forms and have clusters of thoughts and feelings around them that Crowley might have termed as a deity, an archangel or something like that. Jung was coming at them as universal archetypes. So whether or not you come down on this one side of the fence or the other in terms of whether gods are internal or external or whatever, I think it's clear that the work of Jung, psychologically speaking, informs that debate. Second of all, and so it's worth investigating, second of all, Jung's picture of the human consciousness in terms of the ego, what he called the ego as the center of normal waking consciousness, and what he called the self, with a capital S, as the real center of the human psyche, I think is a near exact parallel to the idea of, say, the adept centered in Tiferet as the ego center of the consciousness and the angel at Kether. So the relationship, what he called the ego-self axis, the connection between our waking normal consciousness and that deeper truth center of ourselves that we might call the angel or whatever, I think it's an amazing parallel that should be investigated. Finally, Rigardi and others certainly emphasized the usefulness of psychotherapy as an adjunct for a magical path. And if you're going to pursue that, finding someone who self-identifies as a Jungian therapist or transpersonal therapist, I think is going to be more likely to, they're going to be more likely to have a common language for understanding our magical and mystical work, ritual processes, a broad perspective on the integration of psychology and spirituality. I think that's another reason that Jung's theory is important, is because it gives us that common language with some therapists. And if you want other similar theorists to investigate, I would suggest Roberto Assagioli, that's Assagioli, who has some theories that read almost like Kabbalistic psychology, and also Robert Fraser, that's Frager. He's at the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, California, and he has written a lot on the overlap between Sufi thinking and modern psychology. In fact, he is a Sufi sheikh. So a couple recommendations, because you'd mentioned you were looking for other sources. So I hope this was useful in some way to you and perhaps other listeners, and I certainly appreciate you calling with those questions.
Thanks to Amber for sending the voicemail and for David Shoemaker being very helpful and cooperative in answering that for Amber. The last comment is from a listener named Sora A, and she addresses the aspect of women and their involvement in magic and Thelema.
93, John. This is Sora A from Southern California. Although I am not an OTO member, I wanted to comment on the issue of women in ceremonial magic that was raised in episode 37. While I've noticed that the ratio of men to women is definitely unequal, I cannot say that it has ever bothered me very much. Maybe I'm in a minority here, but I began on this path 15 years ago to learn, to evolve, and to grow. I can learn just as easily from a man as I can a woman. In truth, the number of people, both men and women, who take the work seriously is small. I've known my share of guys who are flaky, unstable, irresponsible, and ridiculous. Some people are just looking for a party or an easy escape from their lives of meager and or unsatisfying real-world accomplishments. I don't see this dynamic changing until the emphasis shifts from highly subjective and potentially delusional astral experiences to experiences that manifest as real-world results. Until then, the occult will continue to attract men and women who would rather scry Enochian others than to pay their rent on time. Regardless, I'm a firm believer that this path is not for everybody. Trying to artificially construct a vague egalitarian social ideal where men and women are equally represented is unrealistic. Trying to construct a place where all opinions are of equal value and merit is also unrealistic. I'll leave that up to other organizations, religions, causes, etc., to appeal to the lowest common denominator. As a woman, it can be difficult to situate yourself within a group when an order is more like a meat market than a fraternity. When, by default, it is assumed that you are there for the party, to play at being a magician, or to land a boyfriend. At the end of the day, the lack of women in ceremonial magic and the sometimes uncomfortable fraternal environment is a leadership problem. So, why don't I write books, go on speaking tours, create a website, or upload videos to YouTube? Well, I'm a graduate student, and aside from being busy, I'm not entirely sure that having woo-woo magic stuff associated with my name is a good career move. This might change at some point, but for the time being, I have to consider the real-world implications. Besides, after getting to know some of the folks who have written books, started websites, and are popular, I'm definitely not assured that visibility equals knowledge, self-mastery, or bona fide magical talent. To close, I think this podcast is wonderful, and I want to thank both you and your guests for doing your part to elevate the discourse in the occult scene. 93.
Thank you very much, Sora A. I appreciate you taking the time and leaving that wonderful feedback. I don't think there's really anything that I can add. I think you covered the subject quite well, so thank you. I do want to note to all listeners, though, that I don't expect that the majority of the listeners are in the OTO or anything like that. So I've noticed at times callers will say that I'm not in the OTO or that's in written feedback. It's not necessary that you need to identify whether you're in the OTO or not or whatever order. You know, that's everyone's business. This is Thelema Coast to Coast. It's about Thelema and Crowley and occultism and magic and so forth. While a lot of the people that are on it or the discussions kind of involve the OTO, they really have larger world implications on just magic, occultism, and the Thelemic community in general. The OTO just happens to be the largest occult order and also the largest Thelemic order, so it ends up getting in the conversation frequently, but don't think that that is the focus of everything, because it's not. I understand that a large portion, or maybe even the majority of listeners, are not in the OTO. So thanks again to the three people who left voicemail. I did have other feedback in email, and I'll try to respond to those people when I can. But it really, voicemail is the best way to get in touch with me at this point, because it allows a good back and forth between the listeners, and that way I don't sound too bad reading the emails that people send. All right, moving on to today's show. The first interview is with Nicole Klagsbrunn. She is the owner of a gallery in New York, an art gallery, and they have an exhibit of Marjorie Cameron Parsons' artwork. So I talked to her a little bit about that exhibit and give some details about what they're doing. Then I have an interview with Keith418, and he and I are talking about the family and its place within the magical community and magical practices. And then lastly, I have a follow-up interview with Jason Augustus Newcomb. We revisit his subject of New Hermetics, and we do a follow-up on how his program and his students have been progressing. And he and I talk a little bit more about what New Hermetics is and kind of get a little more into it. So some people who've asked questions about that kind of can get that answered. So let's move into the interview with Nicole Klagsbrunn.
We have Nicole Klagsbrunn on the phone. Are you there, Nicole?
I am.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Now, your gallery is presenting an exhibition of the works of Marjorie Cameron Parsons Kimmel. When does that exhibition start?
It opens this Friday.
On January...
January 12th.
12th. Okay. And when does it end?
And it runs for 6 weeks. For 5 weeks.
Okay. And how many pieces are in the exhibition?
About 36 pieces.
And this is just an exhibition of her artwork. It's not a combined exhibition.
No, it's a one-person show.
Okay. Great. So how did this exhibition come about?
It came about through my interest in the work of Wallace Berman that I saw in the late 80s, and I went to California, saw the surviving people of the whole California Sans Vicious group in a big exhibition, I think in 91.
Mm-hmm.
Then I did a one-person show of Jada Feo 1 or 2 years later. So Michael Duncan introduced me to the work of Cameron, and thinking that I would be interested because of my past association with that group,
mm-hmm.
and indeed it did, and I thought the work was fantastic, and the life was incredible, and I decided to do the show. So I went to California, I went to Los Angeles about a year and a half ago to look at the drawings that George Hearns had kept in his storage.
Okay, so these are all owned by George Hearns?
They're not owned by George Hearns, but he kept them.
Mm-hmm.
He kept them in boxes and promised Cameron that one day there'll be a show of her work.
Okay. So this is more of a show. The pieces aren't actually for sale.
The pieces are absolutely for sale.
They are?
Yes.
Okay, and what is the general price range?
The price range is between $3,500 to maybe $20,000-$25,000.
Okay. And there's also going to be a catalog. Can you give some details about that?
The catalog is written by Michael Duncan, and all the pieces of the exhibition are reproduced, and it's a beautiful book, which will, you know, is being published for this exhibition, which is basically her first big show, posthumous, but still.
And is that book for sale right now?
It is for sale. It hasn't arrived at the gallery yet, but it will be for sale, absolutely. Oh. I haven't priced it yet. But,
oh, you haven't priced it?
But
oh.
Color reproductions, and it's really, really beautifully designed.
Is it hardcover or softcover?
Softcover.
Okay. And if somebody wanted to purchase one of those, how should they get in touch with the gallery?
They could call the gallery or they could email us.
Okay.
Because we'll also, on the website, we'll have the catalog and the price posted.
Okay. And your phone number?
It's 212-243-3335.
And your website?
The website is www.nicoleclaxton.com.
No problem. I'll also have a link to the website on the show notes of the program. So, since this is her first exhibit, do you find that there's some renewed interest in her artwork and the artwork of this group?
I think so. There's an exhibition that is opening, actually, next week at the Gray Art Gallery called Seminar Culture. And it's also organized by Michael Duncan, and it's this whole Wallace Berman group, and she is quite prominently exhibited there. Mm-hmm. So that's going to happen at the same time as this exhibition, and I think it'll give it a lot of strength.
So are some of her pieces also going to be in that exhibit?
Absolutely. Absolutely,
okay.
Yes. As well as documentation and photographs.
Okay, and what gallery was that again?
That's the Gray Art Gallery. That's affiliated, that's a museum affiliated at NYU on
okay.
Washington Square East.
Okay. Do you know how many pieces of Cameron's are going to be in that?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, that's fantastic, isn't it?
It's pretty fantastic, yes.
Is there any other information that you'd like the listeners to know about the exhibit?
No, that I hope that as many people as possible come to discover the work of Cameron. It has never been shown before.
Absolutely.
And most of the pieces have never been shown before.
Right, and that's as soon as I heard about this, that's why I wanted people
yeah.
to know about it.
And, you know, as you said, the gallery shows mostly contemporary work, but I do like to do these historical shows as well.
Now, in the catalog, is there also going to be some background information?
Yes, there is.
Okay,
yes.
So it's more of a substantial book than just the reproductions of the 36.
Yes, No, there's a text and there's absolutely information about her life. Yes.
All right, great. Well, thank you very much for being on the show and letting people know about the exhibit.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
All right. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Nicole for being on the show and taking the time to let us all know about the wonderful exhibit that she's doing of Cameron's work. Since that interview, I've gotten the information about the catalog. If you are interested in getting it, and I've already gotten my copy, and it's quite beautiful. It's a very nice cover. It's a paperback, but it does have a dust jacket. All of the artwork exhibited inside is full color reproductions. I mean, it's just very stunning, very beautiful. And it has a nice description about the work from Michael Duncan in the back. So highly, highly recommended. They are a limited edition for $20, and if you want to get a copy, you need to call the gallery directly at 212-243-3335. And again, the catalog is limited edition and $20. Now we'll move forward into the interview with Keith 418. Keith and I talk about a number of things in this, but it pretty much starts from the examination of where the family is and Crowley's ideas about the family and its place in the personal magical practice and the place within the community. So here's Keith 418 and I talking.
Keith, welcome back to the podcast, 93.
93, John, thanks for having me.
One of the things that's been going around the Thelemic community lately is it seems to be redefining words and ideas. And one of those that has been going around is starting to call organizations families, and that Crowley was very pro-family and seeing the OTO in particular as a family. I kind of have some problems with that. If anything that I've ever seen, Crowley was very anti-family for its negative influences. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think you're right. And I think that people, again, are ignoring Magic Without Tears in the whole chapter on the family, Public Enemy Number One. And the thing we need to pay attention to here is the way one of the easiest to understand Crowley books is the most frequently ignored by a community that claims it needs beginner books and explanations and interpretations and understandings of the Thelemic material. And I keep wondering if Crowley was really so hard to understand why people don't naturally gravitate towards a very easy-to-understand Crowley text, which is Magic Without Tears, which he wrote specifically to sort of cut through a lot of his harder-to-understand teachings and get to very simple points for an audience that he knew at the time was having trouble understanding some of his more difficult-to-get teachings. So he wrote this book, and the real response by most of the Thelema community is to completely ignore it. And I keep coming back to a Mark Twain quote, which I'm very fond of, where he says, "It ain't the things in the Bible I don't understand that bother me, it's the things in the Bible I do understand that bother me." And this is the attitude I think a lot of people in the Thelema community have about Aleister Crowley. It's not the weird, hard, difficult to grasp sections from The Vision and The Voice that bother them. It's the stuff in Magic Without Tears where he says, for example, the family is public enemy number one, or that any magician has to begin by keeping their family outside of their magical circle, or the fact that Thelema is, at a guess, 90% self-discipline. Another quote that comes from Magic Without Tears, or that Thelema should not be seen as a religion. There's a whole chapter about why this is a stupid thing to do. All of those things bother the people in the OTO more than the things that they don't claim to understand. So the irony of that is something that we really need to look at and study, because it's very instructive.
It's not too surprising, then, that the OTO has allowed Magic Without Tears to go out of print.
Yeah, and the original Carl Germer version is not in print. Carl Germer's version was edited ruthlessly by Israel Regardi. He cut out many sections, and the original unexpurgated version is very difficult to find. I think, you know, you paid quite a great deal for the copy you have. I actually don't even have a Xerox photocopy. I have another version that Moda published, which isn't great, but at least it has what Regardi cut out. But in any event, yeah, the OTO isn't even interested in Magic Without Tears, and I feel like I'm the only person who ever actually quotes frequently from it. The rest of the community just seems oblivious to it, and they ignore it because it tells them things they don't want to hear. But the family thing is interesting, too, because I think a lot of occultists and people drawn into the occult realm are screw-ups and mess-ups and people who have very bitter feelings about their families, but at the same time still want a family. They still want to belong to a family. And the OTO becomes a sort of cult-like substitute for a family. And without even thinking about it, they replicate all the same patterns that they had in their old families. A lot of times you see this very strange and very profound, pronounced denial going on. And we talk about this a lot. You know, if you come from a family where your parents are dysfunctional, your dad's a drunk, your mom's addicted to pills, or your mom's depressed, or your big sister is like a cutter or whatever, then everybody sort of comes around to denying that this is a problem. If your mom is morbidly obese, everyone kind of realizes, oh, you can't talk about that. And we see this in dysfunctional families. Well, the same dynamic is going on in the OTO. If there's a problem, everybody says, oh, you can't talk about that. Oh, you know, don't talk about that. And they're importing, without even realizing it, the dysfunctional patterns and attitudes from their families, and they expect everyone to be just as, you know, honoring those dysfunctional patterns as they did when they were kids. And Crowley, you know, maybe wasn't a Freudian therapist in that sense, but he could see that the family dynamics were destructive. And rather than saying, hey, look, we've got to critique the family, we have to look at the family critically, we have to train people to be independent of their families and to not replicate these same patterns over and over again or expect that people won't do that, the OTO and the middle-class leaders of it is turning around and saying, oh, we need to make this like a family. We need to make it family-friendly. We need to reinforce the family structure. And that's insane. That would be the last thing Crowley wanted, but it's obviously something that a lot of the more pathetic people in the OTO really need. So I think it's appalling, but I think it's not unexpected. This is the sort of thing people like this tend to do. And many of us come to the OTO having read Crowley and expecting a critique of a family, and instead, you know, we have these bourgeois leaders who are very concerned with their families. I mean, the other thing to think about is the people with kids who are parents. You know, our current society just teaches these people that they have to spend a huge amount of time worrying and fretting about their kids and planning every aspect of their day. This is a major part of bourgeois life right now. So the idea that the OTO should serve those bourgeois family demands makes complete sense. You know, everything else serves children and serves bourgeois parents as they shuttle their kids from soccer practice to violin practice to whatever. So why shouldn't the OTO get in line along with that? The idea that the OTO might be something that challenges that and says, hey, that way of raising kids is crazy, or that's not what we do here, or that's not what we're a part of, that's not something anyone wants to countenance.
Well, that gets to a debate that's been going on in the OTU for quite a while. I mean, I've seen it since I joined in the early 90s, is should they make, like, the Gnostic Mass, you know, kid-friendly, or should they have daycare for children during OTU rituals or initiations or things like that? And there's always been this big debate back and forth. And on one side, there's this group that says, well, you know, children are going to be in the lives of people, and so that the body has to accommodate that. Or another side says, look, the kids are your problem. Find a babysitter, deal with it, whatever you have to do. You know, it's your problem. It's not the body's problem.
Right. That goes on a lot, too. And there's also conflicts that are even more interesting between bourgeois OTO members who expect their children to be treated in a certain way. And what you often see is, you know, as my yoga teacher points out, a lot of the people that have children in the OTO are lower middle class or lumped in, can't take care of them. They get into, you know, single moms, they have, you know, divorces, they have these crazy situations with custody with the kids, and that just creates more drama and more issues, and there's a conflict between those parents and their expectations and values, and the more sedate, more, you know, leadership-level bourgeois OTO members with their issues and their concerns about their kids. And there's conflict often between these two parties over expectations and what should go on. And that's interesting, too, because it reveals the class divide in the order and how that impacts on management and the fact that a lot of the members are lumpen or lower middle class, working class, not very well educated, and a lot of the leaders of the organization, because they have to be the ones with the resources and the stability, are, you know, bourgeois, that there's this conflict between the values of child raising and what happens in those sorts of circumstances. And I think that's fascinating, too.
Well, where do you think this is going? I mean, do you see the OTO and the middle-class leaders pushing this towards to be some kind of inclusive, family-oriented religion? I mean, that's kind of where it seems like going to me.
Right, but what's the result of that going to be, and how interesting is it going to be? I mean, again...
Again, it's going to be more like Presbyterianism,
right,
or Methodism. It's going to be more like normative society and not contrary to it.
Right, and the result of that, though, is boredom and stagnation and lack of interest. The only time really interesting things go on in the order, the sort of things that pull people in, are transgressive, are weird, are, you know, sort of dangerous and kooky. There's also going to be conflicts if they try to do this, because there's a tremendous number of people who see the OTO as a place for them to act out their, you know, alternative sexualities. There's a huge BDSM undercurrent within the order that's always been very strong, always been very profound. And the younger people who are there to hook up with each other and to explore their, you know, alternative sexualities are not really going to appreciate being told by the older people there that they have to tone it down. You know, one of the most amazing comments I've ever heard was from one of the very, very middle-class leaders saying at one point, polyamory is fine for people in the Men of Earth triad, but once you get into the Lovers triad of the OTO, you have to settle down with one person and be monogamous. Now think about the ramifications of that statement, what it means about the family, what it means about values, what it means about the direction of the OTO, and what it means about the conflict between the people who are coming there expecting one thing and the people who are running it expecting another. The 20-somethings are going to want the OTO to cater to their values, and the older middle-class people who actually have the responsibility of running it and paying the bills are going to want it to cater to their values. So how are they going to negotiate between, you know, some 22-year-old tattooed woman who's there to be the new Scarlet Woman incarnation and, you know, some older woman who's there with her kids and is not really happy about the way this woman is taking her top off every opportunity she gets to get male attention? So let's look at that little scenario. You don't think that happens every once in a while? I mean, it's kind of funny.
Actually, I've seen it a lot. But one of the things that I've noticed is when I came into the OTO in the early 90s, there was a lot of transgressive behavior, a lot of sexuality, a lot of nudity, a lot of promiscuity. But over the last decade and a half, it's gone very middle class. People used to change into their robes and everything just all in one room, not, you know, really concerned about whether or not somebody sees them with clothes on or off. Now everybody runs into the bathroom just to change into any kind of outfit and would be appalled if somebody changed into their robe in front of everybody else.
Right. Well, again, I mean, to me, it depends on the area that you're in, because I continue to hear stories from around the place, which makes me think that things are a little looser in certain areas than others. And it also depends on the age of the people. And, you know, people in their 20s act one way. People who are married and have kids act another. And there's also a conflict between the people who are married and have children and still want to act out and misbehave at the OTO, that that's their party place where they can get away from the demands of bourgeois life and let their hair down and have fun. And so there's the conflict that happens between the single men who are kind of nerdy, who never hook up with anybody, who are there to sort of ogle the women. All of these conflicts keep coming back and forth, and the order can't really decide what it wants to be. My feeling is if the middle class leaders are successful in making the OTO conform more to their bourgeois normative family needs, as they reject Crowley and move away from his transgressive stuff, the more boring it's going to be and the less interesting it's going to be and the less support it will get. And the stagnation that we see across the line with the OTO is really a result of them basically succeeding with their values and it canceling the OTO or the need for it out. So if they're successful in turning the EGC into the Presbyterian Church, no one will come. And this is, of course, happening with the Presbyterian Church, too. All the mainstream Protestant churches, which they seem to unconsciously aspire towards, are dying out. No one is going anymore. Whereas the more demanding Christian churches, and we've talked about this in other conversations, they're the ones who are doing better. So I don't understand how the OTO really, and I also don't understand how stupid people are when they start making these family-friendly overtures and seeing this collectivist dynamic start to emerge, how that has anything to do with anything Crowley ever taught. It has nothing to do with what's in Magic Without Tears. And if people start trying to tell you that he was criticizing the old Aeon family with its dynamics, that's not true either. Crowley was critical of female morality. He was critical of patriarchal morality. He was critical of the family as a unit, of the demands that it put on individuals within it. And as you know, he says, you've got to put your family outside your magical circle. Then we have people in the OTO telling us, hey, you know, the OTO needs to be more family-friendly. We need to pull the family into our magical circle. So you look at this and you say, why does anyone dispute with us that they're moving away from Crowley and that they reject the fundamentals of his teachings? How can anyone say that?
Well,
it's obvious.
They seem to be in denial about the whole thing, or they're actually glad to
move
away
from
Crowley.
Right, they're not into magic at all. The same people who are telling us, oh, we have to make the OTO more family-friendly, are the same people who say, oh, magic, it's just a MacGuffin. It's not central to the system at all.
Right. It's just this thing that we kind of rally around, but ultimately it's not important
at all. It's meaningless, and it's not important. Or that, you know, you don't need HGA work to actually know what your will is. Or anyone who's actually involved in the AA itself tends to be crazy, so I try to avoid them. This is what somebody said. Now, these are the same people who want the family-friendly environment. This is what they want, and they're going to be shocked as they move up the system to see just how crazy that's going to be. And these conflicts...
Well, I don't know about that much. I mean, because a lot of this is coming from people in the very high degrees.
Yes, we've already seen that they're in denial about what the organization is really supposed to do, and they're also unsuccessful in getting it to do what they want it to do. None of these people are able to produce strategic goals for the whole organization. They're not able to produce effective leadership. There's one scandal after another. I mean, you and I both know this last year for the OTO has been horrible. One scandal after another. You know, one horrible situation after another. Body closing, lodge closing. It's been a mess. So if these middle-class leaders are so good at doing their middle-class leading, why is the OTO looking as bad as it is? And again, they're in conflict. There's a basic conflict between their highest values and their needs, which are normative, bourgeois, liberal, secular, humanist, for the most part, middle-class needs, and what Crowley actually taught. And rather than actually facing that conflict like real men and women and seeing what's going to happen with it, they try to deny that Crowley is important, that they can do whatever they want, and what happens? It's a mess.
Well, I think this is a good stopping place. Thanks for being on the podcast
again. Thanks for having me, John.
I hope you have a great 2007, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. 93.
Thanks to Keith for being on the show again. I always appreciate you taking the time and coming on and stirring things up. Now we move to the interview with Jason Newcomb. as many listeners know, Jason was on the show before talking a little bit about his books. He's got three out, just came out with one about sex magic, has another previous one called New Hermetics, and then the 21st Century Mage. All of those were published through Red Wheel Wiser. Now, his New Hermetics has been a program that he's been working on and working directly with about a dozen students, and they've reached some level of accomplishment within their practice, and now Jason's moving forward into some advanced stuff. So that gave us an opportunity to kind of revisit what New Hermetics is and get some description of some of the practices that they're doing. So spent a little time talking to Jason about New Hermetics and gives the listeners an opportunity to get an understanding of what it's about. So here's Jason Augustus Newcomb.
We have on the phone with us Jason Newcomb. Welcome to the podcast, 93.
93. Thank you for having me.
When you were on the program last, you were talking about your New Hermetics course, and you've said recently that that class has just finished. Can you give us a little background for those who didn't hear your previous podcast interview? What was your first course about New Hermetics? What was involved in that?
Well, basically, it's been a little bit more freeform than a course. It's I'm individually working with people where I speak to them every 2 weeks and have them work through sort of the basic tools of the New Hermetics that are presented in the book, The New Hermetics. And I do that with a CD program that I've created that has 40 different recordings on it of all of the different meditation exercises of the New Hermetics on it, as well as some sort of outside work on themselves and on, you know, learning about their dream life and their consciousness in general. Basically, it's, you know, I began it in, I think, August of 2005, and have been taking students kind of as they've come along and just been working with them through the program.
So how many students have worked through the complete program with you now?
The number of students that have completed it is about maybe 12 or 13.
Okay. And so now with those 12 or 13 people, are you, once they've completed, are they going out and teaching others, or are you having other courses, or how is that working or developing?
Well, basically what's happening now is, for the first time, I'm going to be offering an advanced New Hermetics workshop in which I'm going to work with them together as a group and work on some more advanced ideas and some advanced concepts, and also teach them sort of how to be a New Hermetics teacher. And after that, there are a few different things that may result. There may be some New Hermetics study groups that form, and there may also be sort of a slightly different course that learning these tools will take, in which people will work with one of them rather than with me directly.
Mm-hmm. So are you going to have some kind of certification process, or?
Well, with the program that I've been running so far, I give people a certificate of completion with each level of work that they complete. I mean, it's not as formal as an order, in that it's all personal work, and it's all work, you know, within your own inner being. So, I don't sort of give the same kind of testing that say, like, an order like the AA or the Golden Dawn would give. I basically just say, you know, I'd like you to explore your consciousness in this way for the next month, and when they have completed that, I give them a certificate of completion. Being a New Hermetics teacher, I think that there will be a sort of a certificate that they'll receive at some point in the future that says, yes, I sort of give them my permission to represent me as a New Hermetics teacher, for whatever that's worth. And I'd like to have it be sort of a structured thing where the people who are working with other students are also working with me and keeping me abreast of what it is that they're doing, and variations that they're making on the way in which they're presenting the material.
So you're actually kind of seeing this as a kind of an organic growing process, that people work with you, then they also work with students, and there's kind of this bi-directional feedback all the way through.
Right. I mean, you know, structured sort of thematically on the principles of the AA, but, you know, obviously having a slightly different organizational structure, and that there won't be one, and that, you know, it'll basically just be people teaching people.
Okay. For someone who's not familiar with what New Hermetics is at all, or has read your book on it, can you give some background on just what exactly New Hermetics is?
Well, basically what I did in my own work with the material of
scientific illuminism that Aleister Crowley presented to us. As I took a look at it and I said, what are sort of the core things that one needs to comprehend in order to, you know, really begin to explore themselves? And so I broke it down and I looked at what he did. And Aleister Crowley was largely engaged in the same process in his own work. You know, he took the Golden Dawn materials and said, what can I do to break these down into their sort of fundamental chunks? But he was also very interested in spreading his order of Thelema as well. And while I don't want to stand in the way of that, I think that there are some basic consciousness issues that people can explore that they don't have to have accepted the law of Thelema. If they do, that's great. But you know, I don't proselytize that within what I'm doing. But so basically, what I did is I took a lot of the inner work of magic and turned it into a set of consciousness tools for transforming yourself. And I also involved some of the more modern things like hypnotherapy and neurolinguistic programming into what it is that I was creating so that it's a little bit more up to date in terms of the way that we approach consciousness today.
So what is there an end goal to some kind of state of consciousness or being or understanding that the practitioner is working towards at the end of New Hermetics?
Well, ideally, you know, the state is enlightenment. It is the knowledge and conversation of the Holy Guardian Angel and the crossing of the abyss into mastery, just like any other sort of magical system. It takes a more personal view of it than I think some other magical systems do, in which they place a lot of it outside of themselves. And that's not to say that what the New Hermetics is just merely a bunch of psychological tools, because it's really not. It's magical tools, and it affects the macrocosm as much as any other kind of magic does. But it approaches it from a more personal and internal place. And I think that there's been some criticism of the New Hermetics in that people imagine that it's merely just something that one does in one's own head and that it doesn't connect with reality. However, there's a huge focus, at least in my six-month course, on setting goals for oneself and taking steady actions towards those goals and making your inner work be in support of those goals that you've set for yourself. So, I mean, right there, there's a very outer quality to a lot of the things that people do, as well as the fact that quite a few students who enjoy ritual have turned a number of the tools into rituals. And my intention in creating the tools is really just to create sort of a skeletal system in which a person can place their own, you know, their own imaginative additions to, whether that's turning it into a ritual or adding back, you know, a lot of the sort of traditional terms of magic, the, you know, archangels and gods and whatnot. You know, I never wanted to discourage people from doing that. I simply wanted to sort of present the core principles that were there so that someone could understand what it is that they were doing and then add things back consciously. There are a lot of people who do ritual with the New Hermetics.
All right. But do you see ritual as more just a technique to kind of envelop the mind and body and consciousness of the practitioner into like one focused vehicle that is?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that everyone would universally agree with that, that, you know, ultimately ritual is a support for inner work. You know, it's an outer expression of things that are going on in spiritual realms.
So you're just directing what are the various spiritual realms being addressed within those ritual structures.
Exactly. And what I've done is I've basically said, you know, this is kind of the core principles of what it is that you are addressing when you do any kind of ritual magic. And if you touch upon these things in your ritual work, you will, you know, connect more fully with what you're doing than you would otherwise. Or you can simply do it as an inner exercise. Because, I mean, I feel feel that I'm supported by a number of traditions, both Eastern and Western, that inner work is really the key to real transcendence. Outer work is more of an expression that can be useful in a group context or by yourself, but it's an outer expression, whereas spiritual growth happens within.
Now, do any of your techniques require the assistance of others, or is it a system that one can work completely by oneself?
Well, all of it can be worked by oneself. There's a few initiatory things that someone could have an initiator for, theoretically, although that hasn't happened yet. But most of it is designed basically to be done by oneself. Certainly, there's all kinds of, I mean, when one works ritual magic, there's definitely convenience is added by having more than one person. You know, I think a lot of us have experienced magical groups in which we have a person who sort of runs the ceremony and then another person who acts as kind of the seer. And that's definitely useful.
To help people kind of get a better understanding of New Hermetics, would you be willing to talk about maybe one of the early practices that you recommend people do?
Let's talk about goals and the four elements.
Okay.
Basically, it's the five elements because we talk about the element of spirit or quintessence as well, or ether. The first thing that I have people do, or suggest that they do in the book, is to set for themselves some goals for their life, where it is that they'd like to be going. Because if we don't have direction in our lives, then we're just sort of spinning our wheels, going around in circles. And that's not to say that, you know, goals in and of themselves are important, because ultimately, you know, spirituality isn't really contingent upon, you know, being rich or, you know, having a pretty girlfriend or anything like that. But if we are working towards those things, then we are moving forward in some direction. And so our lives can begin to take shape and we can begin to find the things that actually have meaning for us in our heart, as opposed to those things that we've just sort of decided that we want. Like, there are a lot of people who, you know, they think that what they really need is to double their income or something like that, that would make them happy. Well, if you set that goal and you actually achieve it, you can discover whether having twice as much money actually makes you happy or whether it's just simply something that you've put in your mind as a possibility, and that really happiness is something entirely separate from that.
How do you break that down to the five elements then? Do you set up a goal for each element?
Yeah, basically I divide, you know, the kinds of goals that people can have. For instance, you know, spiritual goals for the quintessence, you know, the goals related to your religion and your life of the spirit, fire goals that have to do with your creativity or your passions or your, you know, the kind of things that kind of excite you and drive you. For air, intellectual goals to, you know, learn a new language or to complete your graduate degree. Water goals that have to do with your emotional life, your relationships. And earth goals, things to do with your sort of physical life and your job or your health. And I ask people to set them, and then I ask people to choose their top five and their number one, and to start taking actions towards those five.
Now, do you ask them to come up with any kind of formal plan or work towards it in any kind of verbal or written way, or is this more just like, these are my goals and this is kind of what I'm working for, but they're, you know, it's more nebulous on how they're going to get there?
Well, I ask people to be as clear as possible. Not everyone takes me up on that request. And I don't insist. If they feel that they, you know, just that's not the way that they can function at this time, I let them go. Usually, eventually, people realize, aha, it's actually easier if I sort of set out steps and begin to do this in a structured way. But, yes, I do. I suggest that people, you know, create both a plan on how they're going to get there and also start setting for themselves weekly or daily tasks that they're going to undertake towards that end. And I ask them about, you know, when they're working with me personally, I ask them, what is it that you've done this week towards your goal? Did you accomplish the thing that you said you were going to accomplish? And more often than not, what happens is that they have done some of their goals and some of them they have not. And, you know, after a month or two, they realize that the one that they're not working on is actually something that really isn't that important to them. It was something that they thought was important to them. And so they let it go and set a different goal.
Now, what kind of timeline do you have them work on? Or is that something they decide?
Yeah, I mean, I let it be loose. I encourage them to have some short-term and long-term goals so that they, you know, have some that they can sort of put to bed and say, aha, I've done something. And one of the reasons why I want people to do this is simply to realize that these things in the world are not ourselves. You know, that what we make and what we create, how we behave, is not our true essence. That we can change that we can do things that we thought we never could do, that we are flexible in that way. Because then that loosens their attachment to those things.
Mm-hmm. So is that your ultimate goal is for them to start seeing some kind of priority of where what's important to them, what's not, and also kind of loosen their grasping or desire of the external and looking towards the internal more?
You have summarized it so well. I wish that I could quote that and write it down.
Well, when it comes out on the podcast, you can certainly write it down.
Yes, that is the purpose. And then with the four elements, I also have people do something that is, it's basically somewhat related to something from Franz Barden's initiation into Hermetics. I have people look at their character, their sort of basic behaviors in terms of the four elements, and then I have them compare the good and bad qualities of the elements that are in their character, and then I give them a tool which is based on an NLP tool to sort of begin to shift some of those behaviors so that they can, like, for instance, if they tend to be someone who has a problem with anger, I encourage them to have to balance that with the positive water characteristic of calmness or tranquility. So basically, they'll work with the four elements and go through a lot of their basic behaviors and create new avenues of possibilities. And basically what I tell them, and I think that it says it in the book too, is that what they're doing is that they're not getting rid of their anger or getting rid of any other negative quality, because there's always a time in your life where there's a reason to be angry. Like, for instance, if you have a student who's not listening to you, and the only way that you're going to reach them is to have, you know, rage that is a divine rage that awakens them from their sleeping state, there's no reason why you can't have that anger at that time. You need to have it available to you. So what the tool is meant to do is simply make it so that when you get to that point where you could be angry, a new neural pathway opens up that makes it possible for you to make a choice in that situation.
Now, where does morality or a person's ethics develop in your system? How does somebody look at that or examine their morals and values?
You know, that's an interesting question, because my book actually does not contain that. And it was something that I was feeling, not that people were behaving in an immoral way, but the people that I was working with, I was sometimes feeling that they were becoming more materialistic as a result of some of the things that they were doing, rather than my intention, which was to, help them to realize the sort of futility of trying to make their happiness here in the earth plane, because ultimately it's a shifting nothingness, you know, that that we need to sort of get past. So I realized that really a lot of magical systems have in their core certain ethical and moral practices that I didn't present. And I think largely the reason that I didn't present those is because Aleister Crowley, in his writings, is very sort of poo-poo-ish to those things. If you look in Magic, the book one, where he's talking about yoga, he talks about yama and niyama, which are the ethical and moral principles of yoga. And he basically says, but these are, you know, these are ultimately unimportant. You know, man is free to do whatever he wants.
Well, I would challenge that. Crowley is quite specific that the moral and ethical basis of thelema is do what thou wilt, and comes from the will. So I would argue that there certainly is an ethical and moral dimension to thelema, but it's based on the will and do what thou wilt.
I agree with that, but I think that at the point in which I was writing the New Hermetics, I was operating from a structure standpoint rather than a heart standpoint.
Okay.
And that's not to say that the New Hermetics doesn't contain heart things. It's just that I was looking at structures, and Aleister Crowley didn't provide a structure, and a number of the other things that I was analyzing at the time also didn't provide a sort of ethical background for them. So I just simply ignored it. Although I have a very strong ethical sense of my own, I didn't put it into the system because I just sort of assumed that everyone would kind of be operating from that place anyway. But so as a sort of remedial action, there's a number of things that I've given to students that relate to, connecting with your own sort of internal compass of, you know, what's right and wrong.
Mm-hmm. So when you're saying connecting with that, is that more of an analysis of one's morals and values, or an amplification of existing morals and values, or a mechanism to examine and or possibly change them?
Well, what I've done is I've presented them with a number of things that are actually pretty Buddhist in nature.
Okay.
And said, you know, ultimately, what we are trying to do as a conscious, magical species is to enlighten all beings. And so if we move our work more towards the giving rather than the taking aspect of magic, we'll naturally sort of begin to operate our magical compass a little bit more correctly.
Okay. So isn't that a focus? See, I'm seeing kind of an interesting, maybe paradoxical thing here, where you're trying to get people to focus internally, but then you're telling them on their wants and desires to focus externally and possibly on the other. Because in Buddhism, people are told to focus on the other to diminish the self.
Right.
Is that what you're trying to go for, diminish the self?
Diminish the lower ego.
Okay. So you're seeing kind of a stratification of the higher self and working on that, whereas diminishing the lower material ego.
Well, I mean, my philosophy on the ego is that the lower ego is really a nothing. It's a set of cultural taboos and ideas that we've kind of put into ourselves and identified with, but really ultimately it has no existence. Our fundamental nature is our holy guardian angel, is our enlightened self, is our Buddha nature. You know, what we try and do and achieve in this world is largely based on our lower ego. So I try and have people work on things relating to their lower ego in order for them to comprehend it more fully.
Okay. So you're trying to get them to see what causes and influences have kind of conflated into them the
right.
wants and desires, but they're coming from, you know, advertising or from their parents or from society and things like that.
Exactly. And in fact, I consistently throughout the workbook that is available on my website, if people want to just look at the workbook, I consistently have people ask themselves questions about where it is that their things are coming from. And actually there's a section of the workbook in the fourth level that has to do with one's values directly. However, I look at values more as states rather than as sort of core guiding philosophies. So it's so free form that I think some people don't quite attach it to their core.
Okay.
Which the exercise in and of itself is extremely useful, but I think that it does require a certain amount of inner ethics in order to really get where you need to go in life. I feel like we all want to experience enlightenment. We all want to experience freedom. We all want to experience, you know, the non-grinding of the gears of our consciousness against itself and against the universe. However, most of us don't really have a mechanism for making that happen. And in fact, we just end up grinding more and more the more we try to resist. You know, if we try and become enlightened, we're actually grinding against the universe in order to try and become enlightened. You know, if you invoke your holy guardian angel with all of your heart and just really want that, you're actually pushing it further and further away because you're identifying it with something that is outside of yourself.
Okay, if you're saying that they're lacking these mechanisms, what kind of practices do you have in New Hermetics to develop certain disciplines where people would work towards those things?
Discipline in and of itself is useful. Just simply doing something, anything, on a regular basis changes one. It changes someone from a person who believes that they can't do anything to a person who realizes that they are capable of doing anything that they want to do. The specific practices of the New Hermetics basically are designed in such a way that they lead us up the Tree of Life. They present to us different ways of expanding our consciousness to incorporate more and more things, of silencing our mind, which I really think is one of the key central factors of any kind of freedom, is that you are stopping the chitter-chatter of your brain. And they lead us to expand our consciousness to incorporate more than just simply ourselves.
So you're seeing discipline as kind of a means to the particular end that you're getting to in the New Hermetics course.
Well, I think discipline is a means to an end in almost every mystical school. I don't think that there are any that say, you should just lay on your belly and eat chips all day.
Or maybe, you know, like eat Cheetos and drink soda and meat and things like
right.
that. All right. Is there anything else you want to say about the New Hermetics courses that people might be interested in knowing about?
Well, at this time, I'm probably only going to be able to take about two more students in the program for the next few months, and that I'm hoping to be offering the advanced class again in the fall. So,
now, the advanced class, is that in person where you're at, or is that, again, more kind of a correspondence situation?
No, the advanced class will be in person with me down here in Florida.
Okay.
The first one is going to be taking place on the March 24th and 25th, or March 23rd and 24th, the last weekend in March, right after the equinox.
And that's only for people who have already completed the initial course?
Well, if someone is listening to this podcast and has done all of the work of the first five levels, I would welcome them to come to the class if they want to. But I would really want them to sort of give me some indication that they'd actually done that. One of the things that I learned fairly quickly in before I started offering this class, and really the reason that I offered it, is because most people that were coming to me for advice were asking about things related to the first level, and pretty much just that, and number two, asking me, whether they needed to do this or that before they could do another thing,
mm-hmm.
whether they needed to do the beginning work before they could do the advanced work. And my answer is that if you can do the advanced work and it brings you fruits, then there's no reason why you can't do the advanced work. But I would suggest that you not ignore the beginning work, because there's reasons for it. So I have seen very little indication that there are people who have actually worked through all of it by themselves.
Okay.
Not to say that I don't think that you're out there, I just haven't really met anyone.
All right, that sounds good. Now, if somebody wanted to find out more information about the materials that you have, the CDs, the workbook, and so forth, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
They should come to my website, www.newhermetics.com, and my email address is there if they want to talk to me directly.
All right. And do you have any upcoming books or CDs or DVDs that are going to be released in the near future or in production, you might say?
I have a magic book that's actually sort of been sitting on my shelf for a while that I'm hoping is going to be coming out this year or next, early next year, that is basically a compendium, and it has a lot more ritual in it than than the New Hermetics did. That book, I am not sure when that's going to come out yet. And I also have a novel that I have completed that I'm hoping is going to come out this year or next year as well. And the novel is basically it's a magical novel involving a young man who gets involved in a magical fraternity that has sort of a mixed reputation in the magical community. As a Thelemic focus.
Is this modeled on any particular organization that you might
well,
be aware of?
I mean, the group that I designed is actually, it doesn't actually exist. It's sort of more like the Golden Dawn than the OTO in its structure, but it's sort of more like the OTO than the Golden Dawn in its way of being.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my experiences with the OTO definitely colored a lot of the characters in the story, and as well as the villains in the story.
All right. Well, that sounds great. So, again, if people want to get in touch with you or check this out, www.newhermetics.com, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Is there anything else?
Just that I very much enjoy talking to you, John, and I hope that I'll be able to talk to you again in the near future.
Sounds great. I love having you on the show. So you just keep me informed with what's going on with your programs, and we'll keep the listeners updated.
Okay.
Thanks for being on the show. 93.
93.
Well, that brings us to the end of another Thelema Coast to Coast, show 38. Thanks for everybody who was on the show and contributed to it. Thanks for all the people who left voicemail and sent emails. And thanks to the people who came on and actually did the interviews. And lastly, I want to thank you, the listener, for being patient and sticking with the podcast, even though we had a 6-week hiatus there. A few closing notes. I just want to remind everybody, in the meantime, between the podcast release, I post frequently to my personal blog, which can be reached at www.thelema.new. That's thelema.nu. Or if you're lazy, you can go to thelema.com and it will send you over. Also, I've been a little slow because of a number of things about responding to the postcards. So I have about 3 or 4 postcards to scan in, put up on the website, and then also send out the stickers. For those who don't know about that, just started listening to the podcast. If you send a postcard of any kind of design with your address on it and send that to Thelema Coast to Coast, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia 30065, I will send you for free a Thelema Coast to Coast bumper sticker to put on your car. So I've seen a few of those around on cars, and they look quite stylish when they're on. So that's yours free if you just send a postcard. Doesn't even have to be anything fancy. If you go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and click on postcards, you'll see a number of those that have been sent by other listeners. And when you do send a postcard, I'll scan it in and put it up on the website too. So it's just one way that I get some feedback and give something back to the listeners. Another thing I'd like to ask for some listener help with this. One of the things I've been doing over a number of years is I've been collecting foreign language versions of Liber Alve Aegis. And I guess this is going to be mostly for the foreign listeners, but so far I've acquired copies of the Danish, the Norwegian, the Swedish, the French-Canadian, and recently I've acquired a copy of the Polish version of Liber Alve Aegis. Thanks for the brother who sent that. And but I'm looking to get other copies in almost every language that it's out there. So if you're in a foreign country, please email me and let me know if you can help me get a copy of the foreign language edition. I'm not asking for it for free. I just need some logistical help to get it. I'm more than happy to pay for it and pay for shipping and everything like that. I just need some assistance in the various countries to pick them up. So if you're willing to do that and you know how to get a hold of a foreign language Liberal, please let me know. Send me email or leave me a voicemail. Probably email would be best for that, but whatever. And I certainly will say a thank you to you on the show if you help me out. All right. The last thing I'm asking for help is for people to give me some musical recommendations. In the last few podcasts, I've been kind of going towards MySpace and grabbing some of the music off that, but it's kind of drifting away from the music that's associated with Thelema and or magic, occultism, etc. So if you've got any recommendations, feel free to send them to me via email on MySpace or however you want to get them to me, and I'll check them out, and if I like them, I'll be happy to play them in the future. So this is I guess this podcast gives the listeners lots of homework. Go check out the blog at thelema.new. If you want, send a postcard and get a sticker. Help me out with some recommendations for music and or picking up foreign editions of Liber Alve Aegis. Of course, I say foreign editions because I'm in the U.S., but foreign language, how's that? Or non-English. That's probably the most correct way to say it. Anyway, any help on all of that would be greatly, greatly appreciated. The closing music is from the artist who does all of the opening music. Every time you hear Thelema Coast to Coast, you get a minute of the song Invocation of Barbarous Names by Phosphorus. And Phosphorus is doing the closing music today. It's called Liturgia Gnostica. And that can be downloaded directly if you like it. And a bunch of the other music that Phosphorus has done, including the full version of the Invocation of Barbarous Names, on the website that I'll have a link to in the show notes. So if you like his music, I encourage you to go to his site and download it. It's lots of great stuff. So until the next podcast, thanks for listening. Love's the law. Love under will.
O glorious Godhead of the Aeons, thou secret center who art surrounded by the radiant presence of the host of holy angels and messengers of light, hear our prayers and listen to our thoughts, which rise from this